Today is Tuesday, November 9th, 2010. My name is Meredith Horn, a graduate student of public history and the intern for an oral history project recording the memories of individuals who have significant association with and knowledge of IUPUI. Funding comes from the University Library, the Department of History's Public History Program, and the University Administration's 40th Anniversary Fund, administered through the IUPUI Office of Community Relations. Today I am interviewing Owen Bud Milton. He retired on December 31, 2003 as President and Chief Executive Officer and a member of the Board of Directors of First Indiana Bank, and as President and Chief Operating Officer and a member of the Board of Directors of First Indiana Corporation. He graduated from Indiana University at Indianapolis and received a Bachelor of Science degree in Finance. In 1982, he completed his graduate degree in Savings and Loan at Indiana University and was elected president of his class. He also served in the active duty of the United States Air Force in various Air Force bases, including Illinois, California, Okinawa, Republic of South Vietnam, Thailand, and Delaware, and was honorably discharged in 1970. We are in the television studio in Kavanaugh Hall on the IUPUI campus, where we are recording using both digital audio and digital video. Mr. Milton, I thank you for agreeing to this interview, and I would like to ask your permission to do the following: to record this interview in both digital audio and digital video, to have the interview transcribed, to place the interview and the transcriptions in the IUPUI Special Collections and Archives for the use of patrons, and to deposit the video with the IUPUI Office of Community Relations for such public relations purposes as the appropriate officials in that office deem appropriate. Is that okay?
You have my permission.
Okay, thank you. Well, to begin this interview, I'd like to start by just getting to know you a little bit better, and if you would tell us about your educational background and where you were born.
I was born in Terre Haute, Indiana, and shortly thereafter moved to Evansville, Indiana, so I always look at Evansville as my home. In fact, most people just know me as being from Evansville. We moved there at such a young age. I went to Central High School in Evansville, and then went to Bloomington campus for my first 2 years of college, and then wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. So I went into the Air Force. That was the height of the Vietnam War. And if you didn't finish your studies, or soon after finishing your studies, you were drafted. Everyone served back then. That was before the option. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and I decided I didn't necessarily want to go to Vietnam as a infantryman, so I joined the Air Force and spent 4 years in the Air Force, was discharged, and met my true love at my last duty station. I had several friends who were up here at the dental school, and they suggested I come up here and study, do my final 2 years up here. So I did, and it was a wise choice. Ended up proposing, and my bride of 39 years now came out and found a job teaching in Avon, and so I started IUPUI after I left the state of Delaware and Dover Air Force Base.
Now, going back to your high school, you had told me in the pre-interview that when you went to Evansville, you played basketball, correct?
Yes, I didn't. I didn't play varsity basketball for Central High School. Unfortunately, we had a very, very good team, and I was cut from the varsity team. But my coach suggested that if I would pick a small college to go to, he'd send a recommendation to that small college that I could play. Unfortunately, I decided I'd go to Indiana University, which is not classified
a small
as a small school. So I didn't play there. I just played intramural. But I ended up then playing basketball at IUPUI.
Now, when you did play basketball, not varsity basketball, but basketball in high school, you talked about why the varsity team was so good and why Evansville was a little bit different.
Evansville was a very unique town then, as we talked earlier. When I was a sophomore, they closed the African-American high school in Evansville and split up those students, I guess, back then, I didn't necessarily know the reason, but I guess it was funding or not enough graduation or some reason of that sort, and a consolidation. And most of the students of Lincoln High School came to our school, which was Central High School, and they were very, very good basketball players. So the competition increased fairly dramatically at Central High School for positions on the team. And a lot of the players from Lincoln, I got to know intimately at Central, and we became best friends from then even to today. So we had a great relationship. It was not about color; it was about friendships, and some of those relationships are some of my best friends even yet today.
That's amazing. Now then, since your coach said that he would write you a recommendation for a smaller school, what made you go with IU Bloomington?
Well, my father had played football there. My sister went there. My mother had gone there, I think, for a semester before she got married. So everybody was sort of geared toward Bloomington. And the lure of going away, a lot of my friends went to Evansville College at that time, now known as the University of Evansville. But I sort of wanted to get away and follow in the footsteps of everyone and go to IU Bloomington. And I found a wonderful time there. I had a great time.
What was it like in Bloomington at that time?
Well, it was kind of interesting. My first few days on campus, I applied for and was accepted into the Marching 100. So I actually went to school early because I went to band camp. Mm. And we were there, I think, that's a long time ago, but at least 2 weeks, maybe 2.5 or 3 weeks before the rest of the freshmen came to campus. So I was sort of an old timer by the time the rest of the freshmen came to campus. I knew my way around. I knew everything. I'd met a lot of upperclassmen through the Marching 100. And so I had a fun time. So the indoctrination was a lot of fun. It was easy. And I had pledged a fraternity out of high school. So it was, I knew where I was going to live. And it was an interesting time.
You played clarinet, correct?
Clarinet, right.
But your true passion is drums.
The true passion is drums. And in the Marching 100 back then, they didn't believe in clarinet. They were a big brass band, brass and drums. So I was assigned to soprano sax. And my passion, as you stated, was very correct. I always wanted to play percussion. And I used to trade off in high school, in the high school marching band. I used to actually trade with one of the drummers, and he played the clarinet and I played the drums until the band director caught us doing that, and he chewed us out pretty good. But in the at the Marching 100, the percussion section was incredibly competitive. I didn't have those talents, but I did hang out with those guys a lot and had a lot of fun with them.
What was the Bloomington campus like?
It was big. A lot of walking as a freshman. I lived way out on Jordan Avenue. All my classes were down on the main campus. A lot of getting. They had buses that ran back then, but the schedule was so infrequent that the easiest way to do is just get up and walk. But it was a long walk from outer Jordan down to the main part of the campus. And as a freshman, most of the classes were in big halls, 100 or more students in big auditoriums. And so you had to be there on time. And if you didn't get there on time, you were hopelessly behind and couldn't find a seat. And people weren't gracious about letting you slide all the way to the middle to find a seat. So,
what kind of skills did you learn when you first got there?
Probably the best one was note-taking. I think the organizational skills of learning where to be on your own, trying mm-hmm. to get there on time, note-taking, making sure you understood what the professors wanted, that was one of the skills probably I learned right up front. And it exposed, I would suggest maybe also it might have exposed a little bit of my leadership skills that I would use later on in my life, I was elected president of my pledge class. Now that might not have been the best thing that ever happened to me, because you're also using a lot of different skills, organizing road trips on the weekends, things, social events, and maybe I should have been putting some of those skills more to work and academics. But I was elected president, and it was a fun time, and I felt proud of that, given the fact that I knew no one in my fraternity at all. I only met my fraternity father because he was dating the sister of a guy who I knew in Evansville. So that was kind of how I got into that fraternity to start with.
Now today, on big campuses like IUPUI or IU Bloomington, the registration process is basically you get online and you search for what classes you want, and the computer sort of registers for you. What was it like at IU Bloomington at that time when you wanted to register for a class?
Well, it was a walk into a huge auditorium, and an auditorium's not even the word. I think field house would be a better word, is the old field house. They had tables set up every place. This is a funny story that we didn't talk about, which just came back to me. Because I was in the Marching 100, I had to get done with classes at certain periods of time so that I could get out to the Marching 100 practice. Mm-hmm. And so they gave you these exempt passes that you could, when you walked up to a class to get in, if it was already full that you wanted to get in, you could show this exempt pass and they would bump other kids out of the class and put you in.
Oh.
So that you could participate in the Marching 100. Athletes also had this same pass. And of course, with my height, everyone assumed my pass was athletics instead of the Marching 100. So I did meet a lot of attractive young ladies in the registration process, thinking I was one of the future basketball stars of Indiana University, of course, which I was not. But you know, you don't necessarily tell all the truth when you're meeting somebody for the first time.
What was the campus life like? Where did you go to eat, and what were your rooms like, and things like that?
Well, my room was, of course, in a fraternity house. Mm-hmm. We had three or four to a room, and then we slept in a cold dorm, made all the freshmen go into a big dorm they had in
a
fraternity
house. I've heard rumors
house.
Of this.
I didn't have a whole lot of money when I came to school. My parents were okay, but not well off, and I had never heard of such a thing called an electric blanket. And a lot of my pledge brothers had electric blankets, and when it got cold and snowy, the windows would keep getting broken through pillow fights and stuff, and they wouldn't replace them after a while. So often we had to walk through snow to get to our bed. And some of my pledge brothers would go in early and turn on their electric blanket. And so they'd run into bed with just their skivvies on and jump into a nice warm bed where I put on a hooded sweatshirt, long pants, two pairs of socks, and crawled in bed and laid in the fetal position for, you know, 10 or 15 minutes until it warmed up. And I got sort of jealous of my pledge brothers, so candidly, maybe I shouldn't admit this, but if I went to bed before they did, I just turned off all their electric blankets on the way to my bed, and they would run in, jump into bed, and of course it'd be ice cold, and they wouldn't have the sweatshirt on and the long pants that I did, and so they'd freeze to death. So that probably caused more pillow fights there. The campus, we had most of our meals prepared at the fraternity house. Sunday night, you had to go eat on your own. And luckily, your fraternity father, along with other, back then, I don't know if it's still the case, but freshmen could not have cars. So you had to walk every place. But we could ride with some of the actives in the fraternity house and go out to some of the restaurants out on 3rd Street.
Do you remember
out
some
on the
of
bypass.
Them?
Pardon me?
Do you remember some of your favorite restaurants?
Favorites? No, I can't. The Huddle was there. I can drive you to them, but I can't remember their names. And most of them have changed hands, of course. We're talking 1964. This is a long time ago.
Was there Mother Bear Pizza?
No.
No, okay.
I don't think so. There was a lot on 3rd Street and a lot on the road coming in down there where the McDonald's is. The McDonald's was there back then, right outside the football stadium. And I guess Walnut Street or something, I can't remember now. But I don't remember, and of course the old traditional places, which I couldn't get into then, Nick's and the Reg and a lot of those places.
Now you began school at IU Bloomington in 1964, correct?
Yes.
And in 1966 you made the decision to join the Air Force.
Yes.
So what was that transition like? You were a young student in a large state campus and then you decided to join the Air Force.
Well, as I said, it was sort of out of necessity. I was sort of drifting in my educational, didn't know what I wanted to do. My grades weren't all that good. I was very immature, as maybe a lot of people were at that age of their life. And so back then the decision was sort of made for you. All males went into the military. So it was just a decision of when you were going to go into military, not if.
Yeah.
So it was, even if you'd stayed in school for 4 years, you were going to go into military. In different environment today, in which you have a lot of different choices. Back then, there was just that choice. You either get the military over earlier or later. I sort of thought maybe the military would allow me to grow up and mature, and it did. I mean, I really grew up. They give a lot of responsibility to you early on at an early age if you're proficient. Probably the only thing I hadn't done enough analysis on was I joined the only branch of service that you have to have a college degree to become an officer. So I was an enlisted person. And that's not all bad, but it would have been a lot more fun to be in the military as an officer, I assure you that.
So where was the first place they sent you?
Lackland Air Force Base, San Antonio, Texas, for basic training. So we went there for, I think, 6 or 8 weeks. And then they sent us to, I was engine instruments mechanic. That's what I tested out as. And so they sent me to Chanute Air Force Base, which is just south of Chicago. And so I came back to Illinois. And then I guess I was again selected for leadership. I always thought of leadership, I confess, it might have been a little bit because of my height, but I was selected as the guidon for our squadron. The guidon is the person that marches in front of the whole squadron and carries the squadron flag.
Uh-huh.
And you have to apply for these jobs, you're just not selected. And so I actually applied for a flight leader, but I was selected as the guidon for the squadron. And again, I always thought it was my great marching ability, as witness that I learned from the Marching 100, and my skills of leadership, but I really think that it was because the drill sergeants at Chanute liked to sit up at the, we had to march in squadron formation to lunch and to dinner and to classes. And the drill sergeants went ahead of us in cars because we had a long walk to go from the barracks to the classes or to the mess halls. And the sergeants could see our squadron coming because I was the tallest guy around. And when I raised the squadron flag to pass in review, obviously that flag was higher than anybody else. So, but I did get a leadership position in the squadron, so that was kind of fun.
May I ask how tall you are?
Pardon me?
May I ask how tall
six,
you
six.
Are? 6'6". Okay. Knew you were very tall.
Yes.
So after Chanute, where did you go?
I was from, again, remember I'm a little kid from Evansville, Indiana, and so back then the place to be was California. The Beach Boys were there, the California girls were there, the surfers were there, and I thought, boy, I want to go to California. So I put in for California, among other, I can't remember the other duty stations I put in for, but California, and I was selected. That's the good news. The bad news is I might as well have been in Indianapolis because they sent me to Sacramento. And Sacramento is no different than any other city in these entire United States. It's It was 2.5 hours from the ocean, so you might as well, we were inland. We were a very urban city, about the size of Indianapolis. And that's okay, but I was shocked because I was bound determined to find a tall blonde surfer girl that I could date out there and marry her, and didn't happen.
Didn't work out.
Didn't happen. But I was stationed, it was kind of interesting because I got in the Strategic Air Command, which is at that time probably the height of the prestige of the Air Force. So of all the types of services I could have gotten in, going into Strategic Air Command was fun. So even though Mather Air Force Base was a, it's where they sent all the navigators. If you join the Air Force as an officer and we're going to become a navigator in the service, you're also sent to Mather, but it had two wings there, the Navigator School wing and the Strategic Air Command wing.
So what's the next step? You became, you're part of the Strategic Air Command.
Well, it was kind of fun because we had a, I say fun, I mean, it's one of those things, it's a learning experience type of fun. We had B-52 bombers loaded with nuclear weapons. And we had KC-135s, which were the tankers. Both of those were on alert, so they would launch instantly if there was a threat of nuclear attack in the United States. I went through a rigorous background search, was given clearance, top secret clearance, so we could go out and work on the bombers while they were loaded with nuclear bombs.
What was the mood like working on a...
Well, it's called a no lone zone, mm-hmm. which means you have to take two people. One person can't go out by themselves. So if I went out to work on an engine, someone else that knew exactly what I was doing went with me, and both of us signed on. We had to sign on with each plane was had a guard, and we had to sign on. So if the crews, while the planes were sitting there without flying, the crews every day would test them, start the engines, et cetera, and they'd find something wrong. Then they put a maintenance report in, and they'd send us out, and we'd have to go out to the alert shack, sign in, go out to the flight line, sign in with the guard who's guarding that plane, and work on the plane. So that's pretty heady stuff for, I'm now probably 20 or 21 years old. So it was helping me grow up real fast when you're up inside the aircraft and you look back and there are six nuclear bombs there that you know are going to go kill somebody or someplace, sort of makes you be a little, start to grow up real fast, which was my goal to start with of joining the Air Force.
Did you think that anything at IU Bloomington prepared you for those kind of experiences?
That's an interesting question. Probably not specifically, but everything in general. Mm-hmm. All the classes, the demands on the classes. Most of the people that I worked with had no college. Mm-hmm. So they gotta remember, this is in a different era. This is a draft. So probably I would think, I don't have any idea if my statistic is correct, but 85 to 90% of the enlisted people in the military probably had no college education. Mm. So I had 2 years. So I'm a little bit above the norm of folks in there, maybe. Maybe my statistic is a little high, but certainly it's at least 70% did not have any college education. So yes, I think most of the rigors and the disciplines that I learned and just in trying to go to class, help me understand, read the manuals, understand how to fix the engines, how to fix the instruments, how to understand the relationship between one and the other. So yeah, and I moved up pretty quickly in seniority in our maintenance office, and probably based on the fact that I was had a little bit more education, a little smarter than the average guy that was there.
So what came next after California?
I got my orders, and my next order duty station, I think I was in California for about a year, 12 months, 14 months, something like that. Mm-hmm. And then I got orders to go to Okinawa. And of course, I immediately had to go consult a globe and figure out exactly where Okinawa was. I confess I wasn't that good at geography, despite all my other skills. Geography just wasn't one of them. Found out where Okinawa was and decided Okinawa was nowhere near Vietnam, so I was still true to my plan. I had not found my little surfer, tall blonde surfer girl, but I was not going to Vietnam, so life's still pretty good. So I got on a plane and shipped out of San Francisco to, first we stopped in Guam and then ended up in Okinawa.
Now, in the pre-interview, you told me about league basketball teams that certain bases had.
We had, at Mather Air Force Base in Sacramento, they had a base basketball team. And I still had this waning desire to play basketball at a higher level. So I tried out for and made the Mather Air Force Base team. And so we would play other Air Force bases all over the western part of the United States. They would fly us in planes, and it was an intramural league, if you will, playing base to base. So it was fun visiting other Air Force bases, and I was a little outside the norm of most people, because most people had to go down the flight line and work every day, and often I would get to not have to go work. I'd jump on a plane and go fly off and play Beale or down in Southern California or Utah, any place they had an Air Force base, and play basketball. So when I got to Okinawa, as I'm processing in, of course my height always begs the question, can you play basketball? And I said yes, and turns out, and I was at, there are two Air Force bases in Okinawa. One is called Naha, and that's where I was. And the other is Kadena. And I was a little disappointed that I wasn't at Kadena, because Kadena was a Strategic Air Command base. And I was sent down to Naha, which was not a Strategic Air Command base, and I'd just come from the Strategic Air Command. So I was a little bummed that I didn't stay in SAC, but I didn't know what experiences were in front of me. So anyway, in the process of checking in, the person sent me immediately to the officer in charge of the base basketball team, and I checked in, and he already knew I was coming from the coach at Mather, and so he said, we're leaving tomorrow to go to Tokyo to play in the Pacific Air Force's tournament. And I've already checked you out, and I want you on the team. Don't know where you'll, how much you'll play or anything, but I want you on the team. So I went to the barracks, put my bag down, took enough clothes out that I could go to Tokyo, went up the next day and jumped on a plane with the rest of the team, who I didn't even know, and we flew to Tokyo and played basketball up there for almost, we started winning, and I started playing, and after a couple of games started starting, and we went all the way to the Pacific Air Force's finals game, which was kind of fun. That's all the good news. The bad news is the people who were expecting me to come work in Naha thought I'd gone AWOL. They didn't know where I was, because I just, I'd been ordered to go on the base basketball team, and that had a priority in Mather, and I was dealing with an officer. I assumed that he would let everybody know everything's all right in Naha. And during the, all the time issues going on, he forgot to tell him he had me in Tokyo. So I'm off to Tokyo, and we're having fun, and we're winning games. And so finally, about 25 days later, I come back. And so then I go down. As I get back to my room, there are all these notes. Get down and check in with what's called the field maintenance squadron. Everybody's looking for you. So I walked in, and they wanted to know where I'd been, and I told them, and they were very disappointed, but then they understood. And so then as they're checking me in, they realized I'd been in SAC and had this clearance. So then they asked if I'd like to go be a part of the Air America squadron as opposed to stay in Naha. And I said, well, I have no idea what the Air America Squadron is, so tell me what that is. And it was a flight group that they had in Ubon, Thailand, and they supported it. And so you flew down there for 60 days, 59 days at a time, and flew back so that you weren't part of the in-country mission.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
I will. Yeah, I will.
Okay.
So it seemed adventurous, and again, it's the word distilled didn't start with V, it started with T, so I said Thailand. Well, it's close to Vietnam, but
still not in Vietnam.
So I thought, well, that'd be kind of fun, it's exciting, it's sort of an elite group. And so I said, sure, I'll do that. And I flew down, so I immediately got on the plane then, I think maybe only after a couple days, and flew down to Ubon with the rest of the guys. And then I discovered once I got into Ubon that our mission was a very, very top secret black ops mission, flying up and down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, Cambodia and Laos and North Vietnam. And it was so small, and we weren't supposed to be there because we weren't supposed to be in Thailand at all. The fighting forces were supposed to be only in Vietnam. They actually took us enlisted folks, and on a regular basis, we flew with the planes. And our job was, as enlisted, we had various jobs on the plane. Mine primarily existed of sitting in the doorway, actually outside the doorway of a C-130 flying at 10,000 feet in this little seat, tethered in. You didn't have to worry about falling or anything, but looking through a night scope, a huge night scope, looking for trucks. The Viet Cong were moving trucks. The Viet Cong couldn't come down through Vietnam because we were really controlling the country. So the Viet Cong would go over into the neutral companies, Cambodia and Laos, or Laos and Cambodia, and come south, and then go into South Vietnam that way. So our job was to fly up and down Cambodia and Laos looking for these little trucks. And then when we would find them, then I'd come in out of this little seat perch that was sitting out there. And then we'd call in the F-4s, fighters, and then we'd go up to 10,000 feet, and then we'd lower the ramp in the back of the C-130, and we'd throw out mechanically, not physically, but mechanically, yeah. We'd throw out flares. So we turned night into day, and so the fighters could see the trucks, and they'd blow them up. And then we would fly up, and other times we'd fly up into North Vietnam and take some people up there and do some clandestine things. So it was a very interesting time. Now, your other question about the why 59 days?
Right.
President Nixon had a ceiling on the number of people who could be in Vietnam at any one time. And it was probably to appease Congress and appease the American people, et cetera. And as I recall, the number 50,000 sticks in my mind. Whether that's a true number or not, I don't know. But I think it was a big number, but I don't know if 50 is exactly right. But anyway, you couldn't exceed that number. But if you were TDY, temporary duty, you were not counted in that number. So even though we were in country, and in country was anywhere in the combat zone, as long as we did not serve 60 days or more, we were not counted in that number. So at 59 days, they would religiously put us on a transport plane, fly us back to Okinawa. We could go back. Of course, we didn't have anything to do in Okinawa because our detail is in Thailand. So we went back to Okinawa and partied for 2 days. And then they'd load us up on the 61st day and fly us back in country. And I did that for 18 months, always at 59 days, and then rotate back to Okinawa for 2 days, and then back into Thailand for 59 days, and then back to Okinawa for 2 days. And I did that for, as I said, for 18 months.
Now, you had said in the pre-interview that your life in the Air Force was very different from civilian life, and that you sort of had a different mindset when you were out on active duty, because you don't know if you're going to live through every day, so it's just a different way of living. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, sure. It is interesting. Even though I wasn't in the rice paddies of Vietnam, when you did climb in that plane and fly a combat mission, And sitting out in the window, or in the door, you actually saw people shooting at you. Every once in a while you'd think, boy, are we going to make it? Now, we flew, as I recall, while I was there, 5,000 sorties, or our squadron did. I wasn't on all 5,000. Our squadron did. And we did lose one plane. Took a missile right in the side of the plane, and a lot of my friends just died right there. I mean, they never survived. I mean, in a C-130, slow-moving aircraft flying at 10,000 feet, takes a missile in the side of it. It's a vapor. You know, the missile just destroys you. There are no parachutes on the plane because on a big transport plane like that, if it goes down, it's going down. You don't have time to jump out. So yeah, you do think a little bit about more than you do any place else dying. A couple times in our squadron, remember I said it was black ops and we're very small. So we did a lot of things. I remember one night parking when I wasn't flying, I helped park the aircraft when they launched. We launched three at 6 o'clock at night and launched three at midnight. So the three that we launched at six came back at about 12:30, and we had to land them and park them and fix it, whatever was wrong with the planes, and get them ready for the next day. And I was actually waving the planes in to park one night, and we were each of our planes, just like when we were in the Strategic Air Command, had a Thai guard. Remember, we're on a Thai Air Force base, not a U.S. Air Force base. Right. Had a Thai guard assigned to guard our plane because they had all this very sophisticated radio equipment, all this very sophisticated night scope stuff, and so they were guarding our plane so that no one else on the Thai base could get around them. And all of a sudden I saw him jump down and starts yelling at me in Thai. And he pulls out his gun, his M16, and starts shooting. And I turned around, the plane's coming at me, and I'm waving the plane in, and all of a sudden all four engines of the C-130, the propellers go to emergency stop, which means they feather the engines and stop. And I thought, well, what's going on here? Because I didn't give the signal to stop all four engines yet, and you don't stop them all four at once anyway. You stop them in sequence. And I thought, what is going on? And this guy starts shooting. I turned around, and on the Thai base, we're in Ubon, Thailand, so we have a whole country between us and Vietnam. You don't really think of combat, right. I confess. You're still a long way from combat when you're on the ground. And I remember looking out on the flight line, and I saw all these figures running across the flight line toward us. And I remember, you're still out of sequence. You can't. And I remember thinking to myself, what are those guys doing out there? That's a no man's land. They're liable to get shot. Those guys. And then I looked down, and our little Thai guard is shooting at them. And then it started to register, and then all of a sudden, little pops all around the grass started where they're shooting back at me.
Oh.
And I just about had a heart attack right there. It was my first experience of ever being shot at. And obviously I was defenseless. I had nothing, no gun on me or anything.
So you have a little.
I just had my little flashlight. And so I just dove down and covered my head and assumed I was going to die right there. Because I thought there was one little guard here and there were hundreds out there. And it was actually North Vietnamese regular soldiers. They brought them in to attack this base to destroy our aircraft because we were doing so much damage to them. And they had actually come across Cambodia into Thailand and marched all the way to our Air Force base in Ubon just to destroy our aircraft. And luckily, the Thai had back in the 60s, there was a TV show called Rat Patrol. It's about the World War II, where they mounted 50 caliber machine guns on the back of Jeeps. And we had several on this base that the Thai troops had. And they came flying up with the 50 calibers and killed all of them, luckily. They found the last body about 10 or 15 yards from me. So it was pretty close. But I walked away without a scratch. So that really reinforced the fact that I better grow up quick here because you're not sure of your next day. And you're not sure of what's going to happen. And so you better start thinking a little bit more about your future and living your life a little more prospectively and introspectively to focus on your faith. And so I did.
Wow. So how much longer did you stay out there after that experience?
In Thailand?
Mm-hmm.
I stayed there till I was in Thailand 18 months. So I guess I was nearing just over 3 years into my enlistment, or 4 years, or maybe just shy of 3 years. And then my tour came up after 18 months. And if you'd served in Vietnam, after 12 months, you got your choice of bases back in the United States. And my tour was 18 months because I was technically assigned to Naha, Okinawa, not Thailand, or not Vietnam. But I did get to put in for bases back in the United States. And so I knew I had less than a year left in the service and by the time I'd get back. And so I put in for Scott at St. Louis, Wright Pat in Dayton, and Grissom in Kokomo because I wanted to be around Indiana. And now I knew that I needed to get out, finish my education, get on with my life. I'd grown up. I'm now 22 years old, maybe, 22, maybe mm-hmm. closing on 23. And and because I was a mechanic, I was pretty convinced my fingers were never going to get clean again. I had grease everywhere.
You'd become a part of your skin.
They were just part of it. I thought, man, I don't want any part of this the rest of my life. But I wasn't sure I'd ever get my hands clean again. And so after 2 or 3 weeks, my orders came back. And they sent me back to California, Travis Air Force Base, California, which is the jumping off point for Vietnam. All the people that come to Asia or anywhere in Asia, they go to Travis, they catch a military hop out of there, and then they fly to Japan, Vietnam, Okinawa, any place, Korea, any place in the Far East. And I thought, well, this is really a bummer. I don't want to go back to California. I've been there. Wasn't the land of milk and honey that I thought it was going to be, and I thought, I really want to get back to Indiana. So I went to our colonel and I said, you know, I don't like my assignment. Is there anything I can do about it? And I don't think it's fair. And he says, yeah, it often happens to his group because he considered us in country, because we were in country. We were getting combat pay, we're getting flight pay, we're getting all the stuff that the folks at Okinawa did not get.
Mm-hmm.
But on the military records, it looked like I was just stationed at Naha. So he says, let me see what I can do. Where do you want to go? And I told him, and he says, all right, let me work on it. And he came back in about 2 weeks, and he said, well, I got good news and I got bad news. And I said, well, what's the good news? He says, you don't have to go to Travis. And he says, the bad news is they can't take you in what your career field is at the three bases you chose. He says, now, usually they'll just assign you someplace else. He said, but maybe it's because you're in my squadron, and I've never had this happen before. Particularly to an enlisted person, they're going to allow you your choice of bases, and they've given you three bases you can choose from. Andrews Air Force Base in Washington, D.C., McGuire in New Jersey, and Dover in Delaware. And he says, I kind of need an answer. Well, you know, I wasn't familiar with those bases, and I couldn't think much about them. And so I said, tell me a little bit about him. And he said, well, McGuire is the jumping off point for Europe, which would have been the reciprocal base of Travis in California. Just everybody that goes to Europe goes into McGuire, then you catch the hop to go out. So that means you're just working all hours of the day and night, all kind of planes and stuff. Andrews was is where the president flies out of. A lot of brass, a lot of generals. And our group in Ubon was like a MASH group. And if you remember the old show MASH, our colonel had one objective. He said, I want six planes in the air every night. I don't care what you have to do to get six planes in the air. He says, I want them flying. I want them flying safe. But all the other rules are out. You don't have to shine your boots. You don't have to get haircuts. You don't have to have press fatigues. You know, you're men. I know what you'll do. He says, I want safe aircraft in the plane, 3 at 6 and 3 at midnight. That's my only requirement. Everything else is up to you. So I thought, having come from this little MASH group where the mission was the issue, not military orderlies, I thought, man, I sure don't want to go to Andrews for my last duty station. I had 9 months left now. And so I'm a little embarrassed to confess this on tape, but I think I told you this earlier. I said, I'll go to Delaware. Now, isn't Delaware up there with New Hampshire and Massachusetts and all those little states up there? And I'll learn to ski. Never learned to ski before, so I'll put something else under my resume. So I said, I'll go to Dover. And so then I came home and bought a new car, and because I hadn't spent any money over there, so I had all this cash saved up. And went to AAA to get a trip ticket to Dover, or to Delaware. Found out Delaware is nowhere near where I thought it was. It's straight out from Washington, D.C., out in Maryland and Pennsylvania and New Jersey, just south of New Jersey. So I drove out to Delaware.
So you're in Dover, Delaware, and you told me that in the pre-interview that with almost every Air Force base, there's a mall.
Right.
There's a strip mall.
It's a mall, not a strip
club. Sorry,
strip mall. There we go. I remember I had just come back from 18 months of combat. My social mores was not real good. I cursed frequently, as we all did. I drank beer for breakfast. And we led a life that we weren't quite sure if we'd come out of it, so you sort of led every day to the fullest. And I didn't think my mother could survive me, and I knew I had 9 months left in the service. So as I got to Delaware, and as I recall, it was August 1st of 1970, when I checked in, and I had been promoted while I was over in Thailand, and I didn't know it. Paperwork took a while to catch up. Well, the paperwork went ahead of me, and when I checked in at Dover, they told me I'd been promoted to staff sergeant. And the guy said, have you re-enlisted? And I said, no, I have not re-enlisted. I'm waiting out my months here to get out. He said, well, there's got to be something wrong with your promotion then, because we do not promote people to staff sergeant under 4, which means before your first re-enlistment. You have to re-enlist to get staff sergeant.
Okay.
And I said, well, A, I have not re-enlisted. B, if it means I have to re-enlist to get the staff sergeant, I'll pass on the staff sergeant, because I get out in April of 71, and that's it, baby. I'm not staying in a day longer. And as it turns out, I was promoted because of the work I did in Thailand, and very, very few people ever got promoted under 4 to staff sergeant, but I did. So with that promotion, they asked me if I'd like to what's called run a dock or work on the flight line. So I wasn't sure quite what running a dock meant, but it's where they pull the aircraft in, strip them all the way down and build them back, and it's a safety check after so many hours. They take it apart, and take the engines apart, take the aircraft apart, check every component of the aircraft, and rebuild it and put it back out in flight line, and it could fly for another 2 years. Basically it was all civilian workers that would do all the work, but they had to have a military person that would oversee it. I thought, boy, working at a dock inside in the shade versus out in the flight line and the cold and the heat and the wind and the snow and everything, I thought, I'll take the dock. So I volunteered for the dock and got assigned the dock and got assigned my civilian team, and found out very quickly that I went to work at 7 in the morning and got off at 4. Not 4:01, not 4:02, not 4:03, but 4. So now, having just come back from Ubon, where I was basically working 48 hours on and 48 hours off, and I'm 23 years old and I got all the energy in the world, I'm bored because I don't have anything to do at night. And I'm also faced with the fact that I would like to make some more cash. And I thought an easy way to ease my way back in the civilian world was to maybe get a job, because I had to have all this time. And so I, as you said, as I told you, beside every military base, there's the obligatory shopping mall or strip mall. Actually, it's a shopping and clothes mall, not a strip mall. And so I drove to the mall and parked my car and got out and walked around door to door and filled out an application. And 2 days later, I got a call from a company called Bronstein's, which was maybe the close equivalent to the Ellis Ayers of Indianapolis. They were all over the East Coast, and they had a big store in this mall, one of the anchor stores in the mall. And they needed someone to work in the men's department. And of course, one of the benefits of being in Thailand, you get all these tailors. So I had purchased all these suits in Thailand, tailor-made suits. And so I was ready to go. I had all these suits to wear, no place to go. And so I got this job offer, and so I went over there. So I'd work at the base from 7 to 4, race home to the barracks. At 5 o'clock, I had to be back at the mall in my suit, and then work till 9 o'clock at night. And then on Saturday from 10 to 9, and on Sunday, noon to 5. And but that was fun. So then I started, obviously, I started meeting a lot of people in the store I worked at, and a couple guys, we hit it off well, and they didn't quite know what I did. No one, I didn't volunteer, I was in the military, and no one really seemed to ask. They said, gee, we're looking for a roommate, would you like to move in with us? And I said, sure. So I went back to the base, and made my bed perfectly, got all my stuff, and left and went to their apartment and moved in with their apartment. And so lived in this apartment with them. They eventually found out I was in the military, because I couldn't hide it where I went every morning at 7 o'clock. And so I'd go to the base and buy all our groceries at the BX, very cheap than a grocery store. And so we had an apartment. So I lived with these two guys in this apartment, and we had a great time. And then I was, even though I was part-time, in my mind, I was also full-time in the store's mind, because I was working so many hours. So they made me the assistant manager of the men's department. And one of my jobs was approving checks when people would write checks. So I'd have to come up and approve the check and give it to them. So
you're working at the mall.
Right.
And could you tell us a little bit about meeting your wife?
I can. It's one of the great stories of the, when we tell people, they can't believe the story.
I love this story.
So Chris comes in. She's a new teacher, just graduated from the University of Delaware, got her first teaching job. And so she comes in, and she's with her sister. This is the really funny part of the story, which I'm not sure I told you. And I gotta remember, I'm 23 years old. I'm know that I'm not long for Delaware, and I want to get back to Indiana. But I want to date young ladies and meet young ladies, and so and I now have people working for me, not only at the base but working for me at the store. I have the salespeople, because I'm the assistant manager of the men's department. The manager worked in the hours which I wasn't working, and then I had all the other shifts. And so when an attractive young lady would come in, I would send one of the girls over to try to get me a date. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't work. But early on into the into my tenure at Bronstein's, in walks my future wife. And I look at her, and I absolutely fell in love with her right on the spot when I looked at her face. And people say that's impossible and crazy, but that was 39 years ago, so it might have been true. So anyway, I sent one of the young girls over, and I said, go give me a date with that girl, give me her phone number. And so my wife, being anybody that knows my wife who might be watching this video, when this little girl asked her, she said, well, if he wants my number, he can come over and ask me himself. So the good news was she was shopping back in the ladies department, obviously, and one of the older sales ladies was there, and she overheard the conversation. And she said, oh, dearie, if I had a young daughter, I'd want her to date him. He is such a sweet young man. So obviously she didn't know me very well. So with that, Chris gave this young lady her phone number. And so then she kept shopping. And it was near closing time. As I recall, it might have been a Friday night or a Thursday night. And one of my jobs, again, because of my management, but also because of my size and bulk, I had to close the sliding glass doors into the mall when it was closing time, and then sit there and close them only with one little instance, and so people had to walk by me and no one else could get in the store. And so I'm obviously looking at Chris as I've got her phone number now, I know I'm gonna call her, and she's wandering around the store, and then I see her get called into the back room. Now, we only take people in the back room because they've been caught shoplifting, they've got bad check or something. And I thought, oh my goodness, I've fallen in love with a nasty girl here. This is kind of interesting. So she's back there a long time. And so she comes out and has to walk by me to get out of the store. And so we awkwardly said hi. And I said, I'll call you. And she said, okay. And she left. And so I instantly raced back to find out, you know, did we catch her shoplifting? You know, this might be a fun date. I'm not sure. Well, it turns out back then, you don't have this problem now, but back then, ladies getting credit at your age was a very, very long, drawn out process because they didn't believe you should have credit, should only be a male, not a female, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they were verifying that she graduated. She had a shorter driver's license, and there was long before a copy machine, so they had to write out everything on her driver's license, confirm she was teaching school. They called the school. So that's why it was back there, and I thought she'd been shoplifting. So, and here's what, this is the funny part about it. So maybe the next day I called her for a date. She said, I'm busy. I said, you're what? I thought we had this agreement. She said, well, I have a life too, and I already have a date. So I said, how about the following week? She said, that's fine. We'll go out the following week. And so one of the guys who worked with me, who actually was my roommate, he came over and he says, can you fix me up with her sister? And I said, her sister? I said, how do you know she's got a sister? Well, are you crazy or clairvoyant? And he says, she was in here with her. I said, no, she wasn't. She's by herself. He said, no, her sister was with her the entire time. And this is what's hilarious about the thing. Her sister is a 5'11", gorgeous blonde, and I looked right by her and fell in love with a 5'6" redhead. Now, go figure that one out. I've never been able to figure that one out. We laugh about that even to this day. So
it was meant to be.
It was meant to be. And so I did get him fixed up with her sister eventually. And so we started dating until I left to come back to Indiana.
Well, at that point, we'll take a short break.
We are rolling.
Okay. And we are back. We left off with you telling us about how you met your future wife.
Yes.
And you were just about to come back to Indianapolis, so.
This is the fall and winter, early winter of 1970. And I had applied for, as I started looking at the calendar and thinking about my return to school, I didn't want to wait till the following fall, which would have been September or August of 71. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to figure out what I could do to accelerate it up and whether I should stay in Delaware and go to school there, try to transfer credits or whatever, because I didn't want to get caught in this semester problem. and just sit for 6 to 8 months. So I found out actually that the military had an early out program that you could apply for education purposes. And so I applied for and got an early out for education. You had to be accepted for a college, so I immediately wrote to Bloomington to go there. And at that time, my two best friends were up here in dental school, and they suggested I also look up here so that we could all be together here in Indianapolis. And so I didn't know anything about IUPUI. I had sort of come into existence while I was over in Vietnam. And I had another friend who was starting here. And so I thought, well, Indianapolis sounds kind of interesting. It'd be a lot more fun than Bloomington, because I didn't want to go back there at my age as an undergraduate, because I thought that might be kind of hard to explain where I've been in the last 4 years, and why I'm so much older here by in the class. So I wrote here to IUPUI and got accepted and got a was able to take that letter in. And with that, I was discharged on about December 20th, 1970, so that I can roll in the January classes. And they let me sort of, they gave me an early out for Christmas and then a 90-day early out for to go to school. So I left Delaware, said goodbye to my love of my life in about December 20th and drove back here enrolled in at IUPUI and started dating some girls out here and called one of the girls I had dated before and took her out and called her Chris twice. And that wasn't real good.
You hadn't told me that. That's interesting.
Yeah, and that, so that wasn't real good. And so then I, this was long before the advent of cell phones, and so we wrote. So I started writing to Chris back in Delaware. So we wrote every day. And as we're writing, and I'm now in school, one day I was writing a letter to her, as I wrote every single day. And I just wrote on the letter, "Would you marry me?" And so I thought, I tell people now, I'm not sure that it was the case then, but I tell people now that I did that so that no one would ever know I proposed, so if I got stood up, I wouldn't have to tell anybody and suffer the embarrassment of it. So she called and said yes. So she flew out here on her spring break, and I drove out there I was accelerating my schooling then. So I was going to summer school as well as the regular term. And so I went out there in June, between the end of classes of the second semester and the beginning of summer school. And then we got married on August 15th of that summer. So from the time that I asked her to marry me, we saw each other for a week in April and a week in June, and then the day before the wedding. So. Now, if my kids would do that, I'd kill them. But it worked out.
It did work out.
So, and then I'm back in school here.
So what was Indianapolis like in 1971?
Indianapolis was fun. As I said, my two best friends were in the dental school, and we were all of the age, so I was hanging out more with the dental students and the medical students. A lot of good times there. And the Pacers were here. You know, we went to the basketball games. We studied. I was through with the party life because I had a vision that I had to get through school as fast as I get through it. So I studied as hard as I could and every night, and still went out and had fun. But my vision was to get. The way it worked out, in order for me to get through, it was going to take me 2.5 years, two years and then 1 summer. So.
And you're a finance major.
Finance major, right.
Now, you are at IUPUI, but it has just been formed in 1969.
Yes.
So it is, and that was not, that was really a name only. They hadn't really worked out all of the identity issues and mission issues and things like that until maybe 73 or 74. So what was it like for you to be on campus at that time when it really wasn't what we know of it today?
Well, it didn't bother me, and I hate to say this, and I don't mean to say it negatively, but I was after the degree, and I didn't really care at that point in time how I got the degree. I knew I had to get a degree, and back then, they drove up the 300, 400, and 500 level professors from Bloomington. So I was getting Bloomington professors. They would drive up and teach the classes. So I was getting a quality education. The accounting classes and things like that that you had to have were taught by folks that they had hired here. This building, Kavanaugh Hall, was the main building on campus. Had the medical school, but had this, didn't have any of the other buildings that you now see. Some of our... It just hit me. Some of our business classes were held out in classrooms right across from the state fairgrounds.
The Purdue campus?
Right, which is right on 38th Street,
yeah.
Right across from the campus. So we would have to drive out there. I lived at 34th and High School Road here. It's where a lot of the medical students and dental students lived up in those apartments up in there. So we had classes out there, had classes here. The lecture hall next door had just been built, so we had some classes in there. So it was a small campus and a fledgling campus, and everybody's trying to figure out what the next phase of IUPUI was. So it was interesting, but didn't bother me. I was focused on getting an education, and it was clear that I was going to get an education. And my diploma at the time said Indiana University at Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't that concerned about my diploma, and I didn't think there was any negative to it. It was all positives as far as I was concerned. My wife was here. She was teaching at Avon and had all my best friends here in dental school, and I'm going to school and getting outstanding grades. So life's good.
What were your classmates like? Were they also older students or were they younger?
It was a mix. We had some students that were right out of high school, but we had a lot of older students as well. A lot of folks like me that had been in the military and were coming back to go to classes, but hadn't had the 2 years that I had prior to going to the military. So a lot of them were catching up. But it was I would say, probably then, maybe at least 50% of my classes were older students, and a minority of 30 to 40% were folks that were just out of high school. Excuse me, just out of high school.
Now, what was it like for you to get back into the swing of things? To, you know, get back into school. You'd come out of the Air Force, and now you are back to taking notes and.
This is the easiest life I ever had.
Yeah.
I mean, all I had to do was go to class and listen and read books and take tests. After the 4 years that I'd just been through, that was nothing. I didn't have to work. I had the GI Bill. So the GI Bill paid me. I'd saved a lot of money working those two jobs in Delaware. My wife taught, so she had her money, income into our family. I had the GI Bill, which was paying me, I think, $600 a month, living expenses. Tuition up here was very reasonable. Our apartment, I think it was $140 a month. So Chris is earning $25,000. You know, I'm earning $600 a month. And, you know, life was pretty easy. It was. I had so much time on my hands, studying was nothing. I mean, it was so easy just to study compared to the military.
Now, you are also one of the few people we talk to that has experience as a student both at IU Bloomington and IU Indianapolis. So could you talk a little bit about the differences and the style of education that you got?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. Probably the main difference that comes to mind now, and I'm thinking back of some of my pledge brothers, they wanted to be doctors, and a lot of fraternity brothers that wanted to be doctors. One of them, in fact, is one of the heart folks over at Riley right now, renowned heart folks for pediatrics over there. They were driven. They were driven like I wasn't driven. And so in the classes at Bloomington, half the people had a mission. And they had a mission of getting good grades, had a mission of being Rhodes Scholars, had a mission of going to graduate school, had a mission of doing everything they could do to prolong their education so that they didn't have to go in the military. Obviously, while I was in the military, they did away with the draft, so that whole dynamic changed too. I confess, when I went to Bloomington, I didn't have that mission. I wasn't driven like they were. I didn't know what I really wanted to do. I just knew I needed to get a college education. So the difference is that at least half the class at Bloomington was driven just to set the curve on every test and really, really perform well. Here, everybody wanted to work hard, wanted to really get into the, they were more interested in learning what they needed to learn. It was more of a hands-on college. The grades were secondary. They assumed they'd get good grades, but they really wanted to learn the process. In Bloomington, it was grades driven. You know, they could care less. Whether they retained it, I think, the day later, they just wanted to get in there and take the test and ace the test. I remember a lot of study groups that we had here, and I participated in a lot of them and led a lot of them because I was a little older, where people really wanted to understand the how of what we were learning in the accounting or in the math or in finance, etc. And so they really focused there. We got good grades, but that was secondary, I think, to people here were okay to get B's. Bloomington, everybody wanted an A. People were okay to get a B and C here. I was lucky I got mostly A's here because I was, as I said, this was the easiest thing I had done in the last 4 years. It was not hard to be a good student. Now, I got, because I'd grown up, I'd matured, I'd had people shoot at me, and I had all the time in the world now just being a student. So it was easy for me to be a good student now. I'd say that'd probably be the difference in it.
Now, I also attended a core campus for my undergraduate. So I went to Purdue West Lafayette. And I know that when you live on a campus, if you need help in the evenings or something, there's always study groups. And when people live on a campus, it seems like there's more of a campus life. Whereas IU Indianapolis, like you attended, would have had more commuting students or not as many living in dormitories or spending all of their time.
And no living in dormitories.
Right, and you don't have the same campus environment. So did you feel like you lost some of the hands-on help from professors or some of the help that you would have needed being in an urban setting with primarily commuting?
Yeah, there's probably no doubt about that. You know, as soon as class was over, you drove to your apartment, which is at 34th and High School Road, a long way from where we're sitting right now. But instead of study groups in the dormitory, a lot of us would get together because we were older, and we'd go out and get beers and have study groups before we went home. So we'd do it in the afternoon. I remember several times participating in helping tutor friends in our classes. Tutor's maybe too strong a word, but not too far wrong. Helping them understand the concept. Again, it was easy for me. I can't tell you how easy school work was for me when I got back. I mean, I was driven, and I've been driven ever since in my life. I wasn't driven at Bloomington, but I was driven here. And I think some of the people I hung around with here and the campus, they weren't driven either. So it was hard. They were distracted. You know, they weren't sure what they wanted to do. I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to get a degree and get out and get a good job and go to the top of my profession.
So where did you eat when you were on campus?
Actually, it was great. I loved the classes. We were up at 38th Street crossing the fairgrounds because they had a Zeb's Mambo Sauce Barbecue up there, one of the greatest restaurants on the face of the earth. And you got to remember, I came from this culture where, and in the military, you know, African-Americans were a huge percentage of the military. My high school was half African-Americans. Color didn't bother me. I never even paid attention to color. And so I was up, and I love barbecue being from Evansville. And so we would, I'd tell the guys in my class that I'd met, let's go over to Zeb's and get barbecue. Well, they said, well, that's a changing neighborhood. You know, a lot of African-Americans there. I said, it's not a problem. Come on, let's go. And we walked in with no problem. But it was funny to see their biases from small towns and stuff. They weren't used to being around people of color. And so it was easy to tell them, you know, hey, they're okay. You know, they're not going to bite. We can have fun together. And we ate at Zeb's. There was no food courts here. There were a couple bars on Lafayette Road that I stopped and got cheeseburgers at a lot. And then I ate a lot of spaghetti, you know, dollar spaghetti, you know, at the grocery store.
What about parking on campus?
Parking was not a problem.
No?
It wasn't the congestion it is now. Now, there weren't, in 38th Street, they had huge parking lots. We were irritated if we had to walk 8 rows into our class. There weren't that many students, and they had a lot of parking areas. Parking was not a problem.
Now, today we also, including, we have parking garages and all kinds of things to help with the congestion, but we also have other resources like the new library. And we had the law library and the new university library. What kind of resources were available to students then?
Not much back then. In fact, I remember the one computer class we had to go over to, it was over in the medical school in some hall over there, and we had to, seems so archaic now, but it's punch cards. We had to do our punch cards on the program we wanted to run, and you had a box of punch cards, and you had to carefully punch each card with the formula in this so that when you put it in the machine, it would read each card in sequence and then calculate the answer for you. And we had to sit in line, and the only machine IUPUI had was over in the basement of some hall over, I want to say it was in the main dormitory for some of the nurses' classes over in the medical school. It was across from the dental school and mm-hmm. into the heart of the medical school. And we had to sit down there at night because that's the only time we could get access to it, because medical school students had access during the day. So we had to sit over there at night and take our turn with these huge boxes of cards, and inevitably you'd get one card wrong and it wouldn't run, and you'd have to count them out again. So the resources back then were not a lot. We had to go use the main library, Indianapolis Public Library. Obviously they offered to let us go to Bloomington, but no one wanted to make that drive to go down to that library. I think most of the learning we had was in textbooks, and the professors were really good about staying within the textbook. Remember, we're well beyond writing papers and essays. You know, we're in the business classes now. So most of the things you had to do were exercises that were in the textbooks or in supplementary books that the professors wrote themselves.
Did you have a sense of campus when you went here? Where you talked about the medical side of things, and you talked about 38th Street. Did you have a sense of there being one campus that you were attending?
No. I confess it was not. It was an amalgamation of some undergraduate classes that were situated in a medical school campus. It was clear the medical school felt they had a campus.
Right.
It was not clear the undergraduates felt we had a campus. We had this building, we had the lecture hall here, we had some buildings up on 38th Street, but there was no campus. No, it was not a real campus life participation. Although they began it, I mean, they understood what they were starting, and maybe that's why they formed the basketball team, which I eventually joined.
Speaking of which, in 1971, the IUPUI Faculty Council approved a recommendation that IUPUI create an intercollegiate athletics program and join the NCAA as soon as possible. Nick Kellum, who was eventually the dean of the School of Physical Education, entered the IUPUI men's basketball intramural champions in a regional basketball tournament. The team lost to IU Kokomo, but defeated a team from IUPU Fort Wayne to finish third in the tournament. So let's talk a little bit about basketball now and how you got involved with the basketball team and your interaction with Nick Kellum?
Well, I decided that I thought I was still a pretty good basketball player, and they had announced that they're forming this basketball team, and I still had this vision. I always had wanted to play college athletics, so they had tryouts, and so we went down and tried out, and I think there were 60 or 80 people tried out for it, and they cut it to very quickly to a team of, I think, 15 or so, and I was lucky to make the team. So it was the very first athletic team at IUPUI, and Nick hired a coach to help coach, and our games were, we practiced out at the Jewish Athletic Center way up on 54th Street. Of course, not being from Indianapolis, took me forever to find the first time I went to practice, because there was no gym here on campus. And our games, we ended up playing at Chittard High School. Our coach had a friendship there or something, but he got us into Chittard, and so we played our home games there. And we would play Indiana Central, and we would play Franklin University and Taylor University, and all the smaller colleges around. And Nick was, it was his idea. It was his baby. He was sort of, if you will, the athletic director. He would help drive. You know, we didn't have any buses or anything. When we went, it was, they'd get a couple vans and drive us up there. I laughed at Nick later on. I said, did you end up paying for our meals at, the fast food steak joints? Did that come out of your own pocket? And he said, I'll never tell. So I think probably he paid our meals out of his own pocket on the way back.
During the 1970s, IUPUI did experience a lack of revenue to support their teams, their athletic teams, and to supply their equipment and uniforms to provide transportation to the different games. And often players had to supply these things themselves. To make that point even more clear, there was a cartoon in the Sagamore, October 25th of 1976, by Tom McCann. He depicted heavy, unusable equipment sent from Bloomington to bolster IUPUI's basketball program. could you talk a little bit about how you did get to games and what your uniforms were like?
Actually, that probably was in an era after we started. Because when we first started, we had good uniforms.
Yeah.
They were the Metros. We were called the Metros then, not the Jaguars. As I recall, we had both a home and away uniform. We didn't have warm-ups, as I recall. So I think we warmed up in our uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
When we went away outside the Indianapolis metropolitan area, we went in vans. Now Nick and our coach drove one, so we're all piled into a couple vans, two or three vans. If we played locally, we drove ourselves to the game. But probably, and I remember some of those stories coming out. Those were the subsequent years mm-hmm. of the basketball team. But that's when they tried to really expand the program, and they were traveling out of state and all over the state. Our program, as I recall, the farthest away we went was Taylor, which is not that far in today's world. Although I remember our team was half African American, and we went into Taylor, which is a primarily white university, and as we walked in, it was snowing like the blue blazes that day, and we walked in their student center, and I think they were worried to death they'd been invaded. All of us are tall, walking through there, and these poor kids just looked at us like, "Where?" And our team was older. For the most part, most of the guys were like me. They were older. Very few of the guys were right out of high school at that point in time. So we were men playing boys playing basketball.
What was the camaraderie like for that team?
Outstanding. We just had our reunion, and several of us remarked about how we had such a great camaraderie. Now, I confess we've not stayed together over the years, we don't have an annual dinner, or we don't have a reunion or a alumni game. I've tried to stay close to the athletic program, and I've stayed close to Ron Hunter and the rest of the coaches and the current athletic director, but that's just me. A lot of them, I don't see hardly any of my former teammates at the current basketball games. Every once in a while, if there's an event, they'll come back, but not for season tickets or anything of that nature. And that's probably just because of the way the campus was back then in 1971. You know, we were a commuter campus. People went their own way. You didn't develop. We didn't have the dormitories. We didn't have the fraternities. We didn't have the stuff to keep people close. And so you didn't develop those strong bonds with the people on campus. You developed the strong bonds with the people you worked with during the day, or if you knew, like me, people who were in the medical school.
Now, what were some of the majors of your fellow players? Do you remember if they were, I mean, did you have class with any of them?
I didn't. I don't think I attended a single class with any of them. Might have had a class or two with Sheldon Oaks, one of the players, but I don't think I had classes with any of the guys. So I have no idea. We didn't have the flashy programs that we have now. It was mimeograph papers programs. You're lucky to get your name spelled right. I think I told you the one time the Indianapolis Star came down and took an action shot of us, which I love. They misspelled my name, but Melton grabs the rebound, B-U-T. So all my friends were kidding me that, oh, you've changed your name again. But we didn't have all the media and all the ancillary folks, statisticians, et cetera, that would put all that together in today's world that you would expect it and feel that it's normal. We didn't have all that back in. We're a fledgling program. We're the first year. We were lucky to be on the team.
What were practices like? Did you meet in the evenings, or were you meeting during the day?
In the afternoon.
We'd
meet typically, as I recall, 3 to 6. Practices were, they were regular basketball practices. I mean, very hard, a lot of running, a lot of drills. Coach really put everybody through their paces. So he was determined to lead us on to good things. Nick was always there at the practices, helping, the practices were as vigorous as any basketball practices I'd ever attended. There was no slacking off in the practices.
What do you think were some of the pros of having a basketball team, a campus team?
I think it was the catalyst of helping bring the campus together. Years later, I had the privilege and honor of working with Jerry Bebko, and when we being IUPUI, was making the decision to go Division I, I argued strenuously for Jerry that this would really help unite the campus. And this commuter campus concept really needed something to bring itself together. Didn't have housing, didn't have a lot of classrooms. Jerry was very successful in getting the legislature to close the classrooms on 38th Street and at the old Heron, which was at the library downtown, mm-hmm. bring everything on campus here. He was very successful in creating that, but he still didn't have something that you could rally around. And I will tell you, I think until we build the big gymnasium on campus that can be used for graduations, can be used for conferences, can be used for basketball games, can be used for anything big, it'll still, IUPUI will still flounder a little bit with its on-campus identity. I was very proud to see the on-campus housing get built here.
Mm-hmm.
Again, those are apartments, there's not dormitories.
Right.
Older students, they're still struggling with that student identification problem, even though I got 30,000 students.
Yeah.
But they need to get that housing for true freshmen right out of high school here. Ultimately, maybe, and it'll be a long time coming, a Greek system here, and then with a basketball center that's on the campus, that it can really unite the campus. It's got the land, it's just funding. And obviously we're talking millions of dollars and a lot of other priorities going on right now other than that. But But IUPUI has also been successful in what it's doing without all that. So you can't fault what we're doing. I just think it's to become a true modern university, even though it's urban, it's going to need all those other elements in order to really unite the campus.
Now in 1976, when they were having problems with funding for athletics and other things like that, IUPUI also had an application to become a Division II athletic school. President Ryan, however, gave two reasons for why that should not happen. He said that the Metros had lost money in the last year and that, quote, the students don't want a basketball team. How did you feel about the basketball team and why it succeeded and why people were able to make arguments for why it should continue?
Well, for good or bad, by 1976, I'd already graduated and was out of the school system. I was following on the periphery. I candidly have to say that I think part of that was driven by the success of the IU Bloomington basketball team and President Ryan's close affiliation with Coach Knight. No one wanted anything to take precedent over the success the Bloomington basketball program was achieving. I think there had been some successes here. And I didn't see the financials, so I can't argue to the financials that it lost money. But I will tell you, it takes a lot of money to run a basketball program. Travel, you know, if you're going to get good athletes, you got to give them scholarships. You have to do all these things to get it going. So I'm sure it was losing money back then. And I know once we went Division I, we were losing money the first few years of Division I because I was on the Metro Athletic Board at that time. And I saw the finances from the athletic director, so I knew that we were losing money, and I knew that it was going to cost a lot of money. But it was a rallying factor for the campus. When Ron Hunter became the basketball coach of the current era Jaguars and won that first NCAA entrant game, he didn't win the game, but he won into the NCAA tournament, all of a sudden, it put IUPUI as a name out there with every other major college in the United States. And I would respectfully suggest that you forget part of that, and part of the growth of the campus has to be attributed to Ron Hunter winning that first NCAA entrant into the NCAA tournament and raising IUPUI's profile, which allows IUPUI to raise tuition, which allows IUPUI to have a student fee, which allows IUPUI to have a better basketball team. I mean, I support one of the scholarships now through my donation to the Jaguars Athletic Club. I help support a scholarship for a player. But you got to have that in order, you know, our athletic program, if you can say it started in 1970, that's probably fictitious. It technically did, but it really didn't start till the 90s when you really got into the program. Well, IU Bloomington's had a athletic program since the 1800s, donors and people who are giving to the program, the athletic program down there. So we don't have that here at IUPUI. So they just did an announcement in the paper the other day. Jeff Bannister, the old president of Butler, suggested that it was like $40 million worth of revenue, the equivalent of $40 million of revenue for Butler to go to the final championship game last year in the NCAA, and it allowed more students applying to Butler. I mean, it's just the whole appeal, this whole campus activity that athletics, unfortunately, brings to a campus. Yeah. You'd like to be known as the Harvard of the Midwest. Obviously, academics reign in the East Coast colleges, Yale, Harvard, Cornell, etc. But they have strong athletic programs, to be sure. Outside that academic prowess of ages of academic strength, you need something else to rally a campus to rally to get the better student, to get the students in general coming. And athletics, unfortunately, is one way to do it.
Now, in the early 70s, IUPUI did not have that identity. They didn't have the athletics to, right, to bring them together yet. But it has been said that IUPUI had something unique. They had two large name schools coming together in an urban setting. And people have talked about there being this sort of spirit in IUPUI, this ambitious idea that something new was happening, that this new idea was growing in an urban area and that it was going to be something new, that they could use the Indianapolis community to create a university that would offer students something different. How did you feel about the education that you were receiving in Indianapolis?
I felt good. I thought it was excellent. It was clearly talked both in the papers, in the public, and in the classroom back then. IUPUI is going to have the best of everything. If you want an outstanding physics class, the Purdue side of physics will teach you that class. If you want an outstanding business class, the business side of Bloomington will teach that class. The dynamics will bring those disciplines in and make it work. I will confess, I never was into the scientific side of the Purdue side, so I never saw it. I did see the influence of the business side, the arts side of Bloomington here. Professors here were always trying to compare themselves to Bloomington and prove that they were equal to or better than the Bloomington professors. I never once thought that my education was cheated because I was at IUPUI and not Bloomington. And I suppose that's that age-old argument between the IU Law School, Indianapolis, versus the Bloomington campus. The medical school obviously doesn't have it because the Bloomington doesn't have it. But I would suggest that in the business world, you always looked at the degrees of the lawyers you're hiring in our business world. And we always felt that the Indianapolis campus lawyers could step in and go to trial right now. The Bloomington lawyers probably knew the law a little bit better, but they had no practical experience. And so it took them a lot longer to come up to speed in the working environment of business. So I never felt cheated. I thought the education we got here was phenomenal. I continue to think that. It is really, the folks here have come a long way in making sure that the campus achieves its own identity and it has its own achievements and its own reality here.
So when you were ready to graduate from IUPUI, did you feel that you had a good foundation then to start in the business world?
Actually, a tremendous foundation. I was lucky in that through the placement office, I had gotten a job the summer of my junior year working at First Indiana Bank. And so I already sort of knew kind of what I wanted to do, but I played off my job, and they kept me on my senior year working basically full-time while I was finishing up my degree my senior year. Again, remember, I thought going to school was the easiest thing under the sun after my 4 years in the military. It was nothing to go to school and work.
You weren't being shot at anymore.
Yeah,
so that's
not being
good.
Shot at. So it was very easy, and I applied to, I applied very confidently to three other companies in competition with graduates from DePaul, Bloomington, Purdue, Ohio State, Michigan. Never thought a thing about it and knew that I'd come out on top, that my education foundation was as strong as theirs.
So can you tell us about your first job coming out of school and what that was like?
Well, as I said, I got hired my summer of my junior year to take loan applications with First Indiana Bank. And I apparently did a pretty good job there. Again, one of the things, I guess being a little older, the branch manager of the branch I was assigned at, he was in the National Guard, so he took off for National Guard for 2.5 weeks, and I was left in charge of the branch. that's pretty heady stuff for a young kid's not even graduated yet. But yet I was used to managing people, so it was, you know, in all my other experiences, so it was not a big deal. I did a pretty good job, I guess, and stayed on, and they asked, and I applied to two other companies for a full-time job. First Indiana offered me the highest money, and that was one of my criteria back then. And so I stayed with First Indiana, and then as soon as I graduated, they gave me my own branch. So I ran a branch bank literally from the day I graduated.
Speaking of your graduation, I was wondering where you graduated, if you went to your graduation ceremony, and if you did, where was that at?
It was at the convention center in downtown. The convention center then was nowhere near what it is today, but it did have a big hall, and I remember being there, and it was big in that they had everybody graduating at the same time. The medical school, the dental school, the law school, the undergraduate school, everybody, went over at the same time for graduation, as I recall. And so there's a lot of people there wearing a lot of caps and gowns. Made you think a little bit, because all theirs were doctor this, LLB this, dentist this, and yet we were the lowly undergrads. But I was just happy to be a part of the graduation. So it was a big ceremony over there, and I still have the program to this day. It was well done.
Was it? Was there a presence of IU Bloomington there?
As I recall.
Yeah.
I could have looked this up, but I'm pretty sure the IU president came up. Maynard Hine, who was the chancellor then, clearly was the person who ran the graduation. But I'm sure they had a couple of the IU Board of Trust, Bloomington Board of Trustees there. But clearly Maynard Hine was the one who ran the graduation, was the person who was in charge of the graduation process.
Because that would have been a momentous occasion, because you're graduating with a Purdue degree or an IU degree, and for a while there was a debate as to whether or not you would graduate with an IU Bloomington class or with a Purdue West Lafayette class. But you would graduate then here in Indianapolis because you were an IUPUI student, even though that's not what your diploma would have
read. There was a, I remember as I was a senior, there was a lot of questions about, by the time I was a senior, that's when IUPUI was really becoming an institution.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some question about what our diploma would say. And there was a big debate on campus among all of us about what our diploma would say and what we wanted it to say. And I remember being comfortable that it would say, there was never any, at least that I remember, but there was never any question we would go to Bloomington to participate in graduation down there.
Mm.
There was always going to be a graduation here.
Mm-hmm.
And our diploma would say, and it was, depending on your major, Indiana University at Indianapolis or Purdue University at Indianapolis.
Right.
And so I'm pretty confident my diploma says Indiana University at Indianapolis.
Is that how you referred to what school you went to? If somebody asked where did you attend school, you'd say Indiana University, Indianapolis.
I've been torn with that over the years, and I guess my resume, which I've never really changed that side of it, which I started a long time ago, says Indiana University at Indianapolis because... And I've left it that way because technically that's what it says.
Mm-hmm.
If you pull out my actual diploma, that's what it says. IUPUI, however, has grown and has its own stature and has been good to me as an individual. And I probably ought to change it now to read IUPUI because it's no big deal. I think back then there was a little stigma. I don't think there is now.
Did you ever hear the name Ooey Pooey mentioned?
It was always mentioned.
Yes.
Back then.
Yeah.
And I think it went away when Ron Hunter became the basketball coach here.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was, in fact, there were even sweatshirts back then that said phonetically ooey pooey, and t-shirts ooey pooey. And it's like everything else, it became sort of a fun shirt to have on because you weren't really quite sure what it meant.
Yeah.
But Ron Hunter, when they hired him, and he became the coach of IUPUI, and they were at, a lot of the, his athletes were saying, "We play for Uipui." I remember him very distinctly saying, and again, remember, I met Ron early on because I was on the Metro Athletic Board, and in fact, at his interviewing, his hire, he looked at me and he said, "God help me if I'm still your starting center." So he has a lot of fun. He said they don't call UCLA UCLA. And he said, so IUPUI is not Uipui, it's IUPUI. And when he took on that mantra and with that force of his personality, I haven't heard Uipui since then. I mean, it's always been IUPUI.
Yeah. So now you graduated from Indianapolis and you are at your own branch.
Right.
What was that like? What was...
It was easy, was fun. I was given a lot of responsibility and running my own branch bank. We were making residential loans a lot. I was very successful at that. They're very easy to make. It's very logistical. You either qualify for a loan or you don't. There's not a lot of rocket science in it. And so I got a little bored and started doing some commercial real estate loans on the side. Not on the side of the bank, but instead of doing my residential loans, I'm out trying to do some strip mall loans and things of that mm-hmm. nature. And underwrote them to the best of my ability and took them down to the board and the bank and got them approved. And then there was some realignment in the bank, and so they came to me and asked if I'd like to start a commercial real estate department and learn how to do it the correct way instead of the ad hoc way in which I was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, sure. I mean, to get out of the branches and move up and keep moving up into the management of the bank. I said yes, and so I came down and did that for a couple of years, and it was very successful. If I could say that, we made a lot of loans. We took a lot of loans away from the other banks in town because I was very aggressive. I knew how to underwrite. I had good judgment on people, good judgment on, and I never forgot in commercial real estate, there's only one rule of commercial real estate: location, location, location. If you got the bad location, the worst location in the world, you can take the best loan, it's a horrible loan. If you have a great location, you can almost take a bad loan and it's gonna be perfect. So we made a lot of loans in commercial real estate.
And what was Indianapolis like? It's in the 70s, it's really growing and changing.
It was growing. The old Hilton Hotel downtown was the big place to go for romantic dinners. They had a big restaurant at the top, and then they built Indiana National Bank downtown, and they put a big French restaurant at the top of it called Le Tour, and so we all went up there for big romantic dinners. And then they built the Merchants Bank building with the big circle at the top,
right.
And it was a revolving restaurant, so you could sit up there and revolve around and see all of downtown. And a lot of people don't know this, but there's a height restriction. South of Washington Street, a building cannot be tall enough to cast a shadow on the sun. Cast a shadow on the circle, Monument Circle, when the equinox flows through the southern part of the hemisphere.
Oh, okay.
So that's why all the really tall buildings are built north of the circle, so that their shadow, when the sun comes around, they can't put any shadow, cast any shadow on Monument Circle.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, not very many people do know that. You have to be around here a long time to know that. And so most of the taller buildings were on the north side, and it was fun. And we had the Pacers. The Pacers were a phenomenal team back then, winning the ABA championship 3 times, I think, maybe 4. And they had moved from, they used to play their games in the Coliseum out at the fairgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then we built this magnificent basketball stadium called Market Square Arena. Oh, if you could only change time, you would have taken Market Square Arena and built it in Military Park here.
Yeah.
On the IUPUI campus. And then we would have had our building.
Yeah.
Back then, who knows? Who knew? IUPUI's fledging, didn't even have a basketball team hardly, and we were just starting. No one could look that far in the future. And they had to land on the east side of Indianapolis, and it was not doing anything, so they could build Market Square Arena there.
So let's go back to your career. You were ambitious, and you were sort of growing at your branch. So can you talk a little bit about how you got involved with Washington, D.C., and President Carter?
My loans were commercial real estate. They were the larger loans, so they always went to the board of directors for approval. In residential loans, they went to a committee of management for approval, but my loans went to the board of directors. So I had a loan a month, so all my loans went to the board of directors for approval, and so I was always at the board meeting presenting loans. I got the attention of the chairman, who's named Bob McKinney, and he was chairman of the board, not a management person, but a lawyer whose father had started the bank. E. Kirk McKinney had actually started the bank. Bob took over as chairman. Bob was a lawyer in the firm Bose McKinney and Evans, but he was a non-management chairman. And so then he started looking at my work, and then I started, as he was buying real estate as an investment, I would look at some of his projects and tell him whether I thought he invested in it or not. And then he was a classmate of Jimmy Carter's at Annapolis. And then, of course, in 1976, Jimmy Carter ran for president of the United States. Bob was the Indiana chairman for Indiana for Carter. And then, although Indiana lost, or Indiana went for Ford, Carter won the election. And so Bob, as typically happens in politics, you reward those who helped you get elected. So Bob wanted to be ambassador to Switzerland. And as Bob told me the story later, they were sitting in the White House trying to make all these appointments and sort of, what do you want? McKinney want? McKinney wants Switzerland, okay, give him that. And then they went down and, well, we have this chairmanship of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, and who's gonna take that? Who do we know in banking? Well, they didn't know anybody in banking. And somebody says, hey, McKinney is chairman of a bank in Indianapolis. Let's make him the chairman of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. So Carter calls him in, flies him into Washington. And so I said, why did you take it? Seems like Switzerland had been a lot more fun than this job. And he said, it's hard to say no to the power of the President of the United States when you're standing there face to face with him in the Oval Office, and he puts his arm around you and says, I'd like for you to do this for me and for our country. And Bob said, whoa, okay. So now remember, I said Bob was not a management executive of the bank, although he'd been around the bank his entire life. So he wanted somebody to go to Washington with him. And of course, that had been the old Nixon Haldeman era where, you know, there was a nobody trusted anybody in Washington, and you had to have a real allegiance to people that you worked with. And a lot of the consumer groups were opposed to McKinney becoming chairman because he was from the industry. Mm. And they said, how can he ever take care of the, regulate the industry when he's from the industry? So Bob wanted to prove him wrong, and he did. But he needed somebody that he trusted. So he called me up one day and asked me to come up to his office and said, would I like to go to Washington with him? And I said, yes. And he said, no, I don't think you understand. I want you to quit your job here and move to Washington with me, and you're going to live out there. And I said, that's fine. And we laugh about it today, but my wife and I had already talked about it because I was toying with maybe I would apply to do the job with him. Mm. And yet he asked me out of the blue. And Chris is from Delaware. It's close to her home. And I just bought a house. So I came back and mentally put my house up for sale. And we moved to Washington, D.C. and worked at the highest levels of government with Bob. But eventually, we weren't quite sure what my job title was going to be. I eventually became, in fairly quick succession, was called the chief of staff of the agency. You have the board chairman and then the two board members who are appointed and confirmed by the Senate, and then I was the chief staff person under them. So basically the whole agency reported to me and I reported to the board who reported to Bob. So it was pretty heavy stuff for a 30-year-old kid.
Now, just because we're running short on time, can we talk about how you transitioned to several different banking jobs before you came back to Indianapolis?
Well, Bob's tenure went left, and so it was time for me to leave Washington, and I had Potomac fever, so I took a job running a bank in, the short version is, I took a job running a bank in Chicago, and this was the height of the 81 recession, and then took another job running a bigger bank, statewide bank in Ohio, and then in 1983, the board decided they were going to make a change at First Indiana, and Bob called me and asked me if I would like to apply for that job as president of First Indiana. So I said, obviously, yes, I'd love to get back to Indiana, Indianapolis, and to work with you and to work at the bank where I started at. So I first interviewed with him, then interviewed with the board and got the job, and we moved back to Indianapolis in 1983.
Had it changed a lot since you've
been Indianapolis had changed a lot. The American United Life building was built during the time I was gone from 77 to 83. A lot of things were new in Indianapolis. That was probably the biggest downtown building that was built during then. A lot of buildings were under thought process of being built, but had not been built. The other McKinney's, Frank McKinney, was trying to build a new building for bank or AFNB at that time, but it wasn't built yet. So downtown was changing pretty rapidly, but it hadn't changed with the exception of American United Life, which was a huge building. It hadn't changed too much.
How did you become reconnected to IUPUI?
I'm not quite sure exactly how it happened, other than I was here, and I think the alumni folks realized I graduated from here somehow. They figured that out. I'm not quite sure. And then we had the really smart decision to put Jerry Bepko on our board. Jerry is one of the brightest guys I've ever been around. Became an incredible director of First Indiana, very thoughtful, very strategic in his thinking. And obviously he quickly figured out that I had graduated from IUPUI. And then probably the biggest thing that happened then was we had just a horrible tragedy in Indianapolis. Frank McKinney, guy who the stadium's named after out here, Mike McCarroll, and one other person, a guy who was an auto dealer down in Indianapolis and Mooresville, were going out on a Grow Indianapolis campaign to seek more convention business, and their plane went down, crashed down, and took off from Greenwood Airport and crashed down there. And Mike Carroll had been in the only and long-term president of IUPUI's athletic club. And even though he was an IU Bloomington person, he believed totally in IUPUI. And so the athletic club was floundering a little bit, and Jerry called and asked if I would assume the presidency of the athletic club. And so obviously you don't tell Jerry Bepko no, so I did. And it sort of really got me back in the swing of things here. And so then I devoted a lot of time to the athletic club. And as president and CEO of the bank, a big focus of my job was giving back to the community as well. And I have a tremendous work ethic, so I could work long hours and not a problem. So I donated my time to a lot of organizations, but IUPUI has been right up to the top of it. And the athletic program, helping the athletic program grow, helping recruit Ron Hunter, and all that's been done since then. I've tried to help IUPUI with my money as well as my time.
Now, in the pre-interview, you talked about how IUPUI students go out into the Indianapolis community and get real life experience, and about how you have helped students by sort of mentoring and being a help to them because of your work in finance and the banking world. So can you talk a little bit about how you got involved with that?
We decided to, we wanted to endow a chair, a banking chair, at a university. And so we talked to the folks at Bloomington about it and Purdue about it and found out that their idea of endowing a chair is in the millions. IUPUI, on the other hand, had a little less lofty goals. They were happy to get the money. And so we were able to endow a chair here in the business school for a lot less money. And a focus on banking curriculum, because we wanted that. And we wanted, because I was familiar with the kind of student that came out of IUPUI, a little older, a little more mature, ready to get in the work stream, work hard. We wanted to make sure they had a firm foundation and a banking curriculum. So we created the first Indiana Scholar here at the in the business school, and really was successful. So as a result of that, I got to know the deans of the business school. Obviously, I had my connection with Jerry, and spoke a lot at the business school, etc. Not in classroom settings, but in convention type meetings and graduation meetings and orientation meetings, things of that nature. Not a graduation speaker, no. I'm not trying to say that. More orientation for the business school when they come in or getting ready to graduate. I would speak as president of First Indiana Bank. They had the latest focus is they had the great idea that how do you differentiate, and it's now Ed Kelly donated the money to the IU Business School, so they named the business school after him. So you had the Kelly School, Indianapolis, Kelly School, Bloomington. So as the Indianapolis folks are thinking through strategically, how do we differentiate between the two schools? It was real apparent real fast that one of the things that Indianapolis had that Bloomington did not have was a business community, a huge business community. So they created what's called the SoftWiki program, and they got 30 of us CEOs in the town to come in, and we are now mentoring five MBA students at a time in what's called the SoftWiki program, and it's Greek for sophomore graduating or something like that. And I have five MBA students that I meet with three or four times a year, and I try to mentor them on what it takes to become a successful business person. And it's really been a great program. I've enjoyed that a lot.
Well, very quickly here as we wrap up, since your time at IUPUI and in Indianapolis, what would you say has been the most significant change on campus?
I think the most significant change has been the growth of the campus, the legislature funding them, and the strategic vision of the administrators here, first with Jerry and then with Charles Bantz, of putting housing on campus, growing the student body, creating the athletics into Division I to have the campus have a unifying effort, putting more emphasis on growing the university where there's a real tradition here, that we're beginning these traditions. We don't have the age or the tenure that some of the older campuses have. So we'll start it now. I think it's starting to really grow, and people are starting to get enough graduates out there that people are understanding it.
Well, is there anything else that I've not asked you about IUPUI that you would like to add?
Nothing I can think of. You've been very thorough. You've done a wonderful job. I just think it'd be fun to watch people talk about IUPUI another 40 years from now and see where it is. It'll be pretty dramatic change, I suspect. If you take the growth in the first 40 and project it forward into the next 40, I think it's going to be phenomenal.
Hopefully they have a basketball arena.
Yeah, I hope so.
Okay. Thank you again for coming in today.
My pleasure. Thank you.